and this is something which in the final analysis should not concern a true Catholic Christian. I mean that a heretic laughs at him because he gives priority to the reverence and trust which is due to the sacred authors over all the arguments and observations of astronomers and philosophers put together." Galileo could not repeat his real reasons for embracing both Copernicus and the Bible, as expressed in his letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, for the edict had indeed prohibited that kind of exegesis. For the moment, and the unforeseeable future, he let his Catholic faith dictate the form in which he framed his arguments. From this safe position, Galileo found he could once again dare to defend Copernicus. "For, Signor Ingoli, if your philosophical sincerity and my old regard for you will allow me to say so, you should in all honesty have known that Nicholas Copernicus had spent more years on these very difficult studies than you had spent days on them. So you should have been more careful and not let yourself be lightly persuaded that you could knock down such a man, especially with the sort of weapons you use, which are among the most common and trite objections advanced in this subject. And, though you add something new, this is no more effective than the rest. Thus, did you really think that Nicholas Copernicus did not grasp the mysteries of the extremely shallow Sacro Bosco? That he did not understand parallax? That he had not read and understood Ptolemy and Aristotle? I am not surprised that you believed you could convince him, given that you thought so little of him. However, if you had read him with the care required to understand him properly, at least the difficulty of the subject, if nothing else, would have confused your spirit of opposition so that you would have refrained or completely abstained from taking such a step. Since what is done is done, let us try as far as possible to prevent you or others from multiplying errors. So I come to the arguments you give to prove that the earth and not the sun is located at the center of the universe." Galileo's ire rises through the response, aggravated by his frustration with Ingoli's faulty logic, leading him to an emphatic statement of his own position. "If any place in the world is to be called its center, that is the center of celestial revolutions, and everyone who is competent in this subject knows that it is the sun rather than the earth which is found therein." Galileo sent off his 50-page reply to Ingoli to friends in Rome in October of 1624. Curiously, because of lengthy delays caused by changes Prince Chasi and other Roman colleagues wished to insert for prudence's sake, the reply to Ingoli never reached Ingoli himself. A few manuscript copies circulated cautiously around Rome, however, and the Pope was treated to at least a partial private reading in December. No explosion erupted from Urban in reaction to the reply. Indeed, His Holiness remarked on the aptness of its examples and experiments. And therefore no apparent obstacle stood in the way of Galileo's expressing the same ideas in a book, which he now envisioned as a play-like discussion among a group of fictional friends, with the working title, Dialogue on the Tides. Chapter 13. Through My Memory of Their Eloquence. Galileo threw himself into the work on the new book with all the force that his science, his religion, his life experience, and his flair for the dramatic allowed. The topic deserved nothing less. "The constitution of the universe," Galileo said in dedicating his dialogue to the Grand Duke of Tuscany, "may be set in first place among all natural things that can be known. For coming before all others in grandeur by reason of its universal content, it must also stand above them all in nobility as their rule and standard. Therefore, if any men might claim extreme distinction in intellect above all mankind, Ptolemy and Copernicus were such men whose gaze was thus raised on high and who philosophized about the constitution of the world. These dialogues of mine set forth the teaching of these two men, whom I consider the greatest minds ever to have left us such contemplations in their works." The writing of the dialogue, occupied him intermittently for a period of 6 years following his 1624 meetings with Pope Urban. Since Galileo had actually begun thinking about the subject matter long before that, however, and even previously written the backbones of certain sections in non-dialogue form, such as his Treatise on the Tides, he personally considered the book the product of a decade's gestation. Galileo had experimented with the dialogue style in his humorous exposition on the Nova of 1604, as well as in actual playwriting for his family and friends. And his father had employed dialogue to write about ancient and modern music. Aside from the dialogue's popularity for presenting scientific issues, the format offered Galileo a measure of protection by putting the shortcomings of Ptolemy and the merits of Copernicus into the mouths of dramatis personae. The author could distance himself from their sensitive discussions as though he were an impartial bystander. In addition, the dialogue form allowed the characters occasionally to veer off the main theme to treat other topics. Magnetism, for example, that Galileo deemed no less interesting than the principal argument. His book took the form of an animated encounter spread over 4 days' time, like a play in four acts, among three acquaintances who breathed their own personalities into the theories they entertained. The character he called Salviati, a thinly disguised alter ego, spoke Galileo's own mind. Sagredo, an intelligent and receptive man of means, typically took Salviati's side. Simplicio, on the other hand, a pompous Aristotelian philosopher who loved to drop Latin phrases, would often wax prolix on a topic before being played for a fool. Galileo also inserted himself as a minor character in the work by having the men cite the authority of the Lynxian academician from time to time, or allude to the discoveries and ideas of our mutual friend. Galileo, over 60 now, had reached the stage in life at which many of his own dearest friends had already died. But in the dialogue he brought two of the departed back to life for all time. Filippo Salviati, the gracious host at whose Florentine Villa delle Selve Galileo had resided for long periods, writing while recuperating from illnesses, and Giovan Francesco Sagredo, who had been a private student at Galileo's at Padua and kept in close touch with him till his death in Venice in 1620. The name Simplicio recalled no particular colleague of Galileo's, but rather the 6th-century Greek philosopher Simplicius, a renowned commentator on Aristotle. Behind that ancient identity hid some unspecified pedant, thought to be Cesare Cremonini, University of Padua philosopher, who had frequently opposed Galileo in debate. Of course, the name Simplicio also sounded something like Sempliciotto, or simpleton, which could hardly have escaped Galileo's notice and might well have been his intention. Many years ago, in the marvelous city of Venice, Galileo recounted in the dialogue's preface, I had several occasions to engage in conversation with Giovan Francesco Sagredo, a man of most illustrious family and of sharpest mind. From Florence we were visited by Filippo Salviati, whose least glory was purity of blood and magnificence of riches, his sublime intellect fed on no delight more avidly than on refined speculations. Galileo had often drawn these two out on the three main topics to be considered in the dialogue, namely the question of the earth's motion, the organization of the heavenly bodies, and the ebb and flow of the sea. Now, since bitter death has deprived Venice and Florence of those two great luminaries in the very meridian of their years, I have decided to prolong their existence so far as my poor abilities will permit by reviving them in these pages of mine and using them as interlocutors in the present controversy. May it please those two great souls, ever venerable in my heart, to receive with favor this public monument of my undying friendship, and may they assist me, through my memory of their eloquence, to explain to posterity the promised reflections. The action of the dialogue unfolds at Sagredo's palazzo in Venice, where his guests, Salviati and Simplicio, arrive each day by gondola. The three have earmarked these 4 days, according to the conceit of the book, for their mutual enlightenment, to isolate themselves for an intellectual retreat so as to discuss as clearly and in as much detail as possible the two chief systems of the world, as the universe was then commonly called. Writing in Italian for a mass audience, Galileo laced the 500-page dialogue with grand, gorgeous language by turns poetic, didactic, reverent, combative, and funny. He illustrated the text, too, but only sparsely, by having his characters create simple line drawings for each other as need arose. "Just seeing the diagram has cleared the whole matter up," Sagredo says gratefully to the more learned Salviati at one such juncture. "So, go on." In the margins of almost every page, where Galileo normally penned notes to himself in the books he read, he put postals, short phrases that described the content of the paragraphs or reiterated their main points. A few densely numerical tables of observational data also entered the dialogue, but not until the morning of day 3, by which time the lay reader had been prepared either to absorb them or skip over them without losing the gist. As for the central dilemma of the dialogue, the challenge of championing Copernicus without alienating the Church, Galileo faced it on the very first page of his preface. Here he took pains to explain the delicate situation in Italy, where a scientist, he, Galileo, had made vital discoveries pertaining to the Copernican doctrine, but where the doctrine itself ran afoul of the reigning religious authorities. He had intimated as much in his reply to Ingoli. Now he stated his position for the record, addressing the discerning reader as follows. "Some years ago, there was published in Rome a salutary edict which, in order to obviate the dangerous tendencies of our present age, imposed a seasonable silence upon the Pythagorean opinion that the earth moves. There were those who impudently asserted that this decree had its origin not in judicious inquiry, but in passion none too well informed. Complaints were to be heard that advisers who were totally unskilled at astronomical observations ought not to clip the wings of reflective intellects by means of rash prohibitions." Indeed, Galileo himself had expressed exactly these sentiments in his letter to the Grand Duchess Christina. But he wrote that plea before the edict was issued. After the fact of the edict, he did not gainsay the Holy Fathers. The dialogue resumed his importuning that truths about nature be allowed to emerge through science. Such truths, he still believed, could only glorify the word and deeds of God. "Upon hearing such carping insolence," he continued in the preface, "my zeal could not be contained. Being thoroughly informed about that prudent determination, I decided to appear openly in the theater of the world as a witness of the sober truth. I was at that time in Rome. I was not only received by the most eminent prelates of that court, but had their applause. Indeed, this decree was not published without some previous notice of it having been given to me. Therefore, I propose in the present work to show to foreign nations that as much is understood of this matter in Italy, and particularly in Rome, as transalpine diligence can ever have imagined. Collecting all the reflections that properly concern the Copernican system, I shall make it known that everything was brought before the attention of the Roman censorship, and that there proceed from this clime not only dogmas for the welfare of the soul, but ingenious discoveries for the delight of the mind as well." Then day 1 opens like a curtain rising, with the characters already assembled and their conversation coming immediately to the point. The day's discussions draw the dividing lines between the Aristotelian, Ptolemaic, and the Copernican world views. To that end, Simplicio propounds Aristotle's view of the earth as fundamentally different from all celestial bodies, in that it comprises elements instead of ether. Salviati, a la Galileo, seeks to find the earth a place in heaven, and Sagredo good-naturedly grants the earth the dregs of the universe, the sink of all uncleanness, a unique strength born of its characteristic susceptibility to change. For my part, I consider the earth very noble and admirable precisely because of the diverse alterations, changes, generations, etc., that occur in it incessantly. If, not being subject to any changes, it were a vast desert of sand or a mountain of jasper, or if at the time of the flood the waters which covered it had frozen and it had remained an enormous globe of ice where nothing was ever born or ever altered or changed, I should deem it a useless lump in the universe, devoid of activity and, in a word, superfluous and essentially non-existent. Salviati backs him up with the evidence from their friend's telescope about how the sun also changes via spots erupting and receding round and round its girth. He suggests that the moon, too, may be changing, and all the stars as well, fixed or wandering, but that the changes have thus far escaped detection. Immutability, which Aristotle had deemed a defining quality of perfect orbs, here dissolves into a simple lack of information. The deeper I go in considering the vanities of popular reasoning, the host, Sagredo resumes his musing, the lighter and more foolish I find them. What greater stupidity can be imagined than that of calling jewels, silver and gold, precious, and earth and soil, base? People who do this ought to remember that if there were as great a scarcity of soil as of jewels or precious metals, there would not be a prince who would not spend a bushel of diamonds and rubies and a cartload of gold just to have enough earth to plant a jasmine in a little pot, or to sow an orange seed and watch it sprout, grow and produce its handsome leaves, its fragrant flowers, and fine fruit. It is scarcity and plenty that make the vulgar take things to be precious or worthless. They call a diamond very beautiful because it is like pure water, and then would not exchange one for 10 barrels of water. Those who so greatly exalt incorruptibility, inalterability, etc., are reduced to talking this way, I believe, by their great desire to go on living and by the terror they have of death. These individuals do not reflect that if men were immortal, they themselves would never have come into the world. Such men really deserve to encounter a Medusa's head, which would transmute them into statues of jasper or of diamond, and thus make them more perfect than they are. Illness interrupted Galileo's progress in the dialogue in March of 1625. Though he recovered relatively quickly, he did not return to the book right away. Guiducci, his former live-in student and co-author in the Comet controversy, wrote to him from Rome that some unnamed pious person had lodged complaints with the Holy Office of the Inquisition about the assayer on the grounds that it undermined the sacrament of the Eucharist. Galileo had commented in the assayer on the nature of matter, how it breaks down into even smaller parts that lose all resemblance to familiar objects. This philosophy seemed to question the integrity of the bread offered in the Mass as the body of Christ and the wine that was his blood. As a precaution, Guiducci advised Galileo to muffle his reply to Ingoli for the time being, since its praise of Copernicus was unabashed, and Galileo took the further prudent measure of suspending work on the dialogue. He occupied himself with other interests of his own and his official duties as philosopher to the Grand Duke, who called on Galileo to evaluate the schemes and machines that enterprising inventors try to sell the Tuscan government. One such offering purported to pump water with miraculous efficiency, and another to revolutionize the milling of grain. After attending model demonstrations, Galileo would write polite but often daunting letters to the inventors, explaining the hopelessness of their ideas on the basis of the principles of simple machines. I cannot deny that I was admiring and confused when, in the presence of the Grand Duke and other princes and gentlemen, you exhibited the model of your machine of truly subtle invention. Galileo began his critique of the would-be water pump. And since I long ago formed the idea, confirmed by many experiments, that nature cannot be overcome and defrauded by art, he added soon after, I have made an accumulation of thoughts and have decided to put them on paper and communicate them to you in order that if the success of your truly acute invention is seen in practice and in very large machines, I may be excused by you and through you excused by others. At the same juncture, in 1625, Galileo also gave mathematical critiques on papers he received from his correspondents in Pisa, Milan, Genoa, Rome, and Bologna concerning their thoughts on the dynamics of river flow, the refraction of light, the acceleration of bodies in fall, and the nature of indivisible points. In his spare time, Galileo repaired to his garden, where he indulged the pleasure he had described of planting orange seeds and lemons and chartreuse-colored citrons in large terracotta pots. Galileo regularly sent the best of the citrons to Suor Maria Celeste, who would seed, soak, dry, and sweeten them over a period of several days to prepare his favorite confection. Having fared poorly with the fruits he consigned to her just before Christmas 1625, however, she sought a few other tokens she hoped would please him. "Most illustrious and beloved Lord Father, as for the citron which you commanded me, sire, to make into candy, I have come up with only this little bit that I send you now, because I am afraid the fruit was not fresh enough for the confection to reach the state of perfection I would have liked, and indeed it did not turn out very well after all. Along with this, I am sending you 2 baked pears for these festive days. But to present you with an even more special gift, I enclose a rose, which, as an extraordinary thing in this cold season, must be warmly welcomed by you. And all the more so, since, together with the rose, you will be able to accept the thorns that represent the bitter suffering of our Lord, and also its green leaves, symbolizing the hope that we nurture by virtue of this holy passion of the reward that awaits us. After the brevity and darkness of the winter of the present life, when at last we will enter the clarity and happiness of the eternal spring of heaven, which blessed God grants us by his mercy. And ending here, I give you loving greetings, together with Suor Arcangela, and remind you, sire, that both of us are all eagerness to hear the current state of your health. From San Mateo, the 19th day of December 1625. Most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. I am returning the tablecloth in which you wrapped the lamb you sent. And you, sire, have a pillowcase of ours, which we put over the shirts in the basket with the lid. The garden at the convent of San Matteo in Arcetri, where a rose could bloom at Christmas time, devoted much of its earthly paradise to herbs and medicinal plants, the likes of rosemary, good for treating nausea, and rue, applied directly to the nostrils to staunch a bloody nose, or drunk with wine for headache. These grew among the pine, plum, and pear trees ranged around a central well in back of the church. Even the decorative rose bushes served an apothecary's purpose, for the syrup of cooked, compressed rosebuds made an excellent purgative, prepared from several hundred roses, picked when the buds were half open, then steeped a full day and night in sugar and hot water. Just beyond the garden, the fragrant almond trees and evergreen olive trees cascaded down the slope behind the convent, where walkways led the nuns easily into Franciscan communion with nature. The convent's walled perimeter, not to mention the rule of enclosure, detained Suor Maria Celeste in an anteroom of the afterlife. Rather than resent this separation from worldly affairs, cloistered monks and nuns at that time typically developed fierce attachments to their self-contained communities, where some spent long lifetimes, like the aunt of Pope Urban VIII, who lived 81 years at her convent, and where, according to contemporary record books, miracles occurred as matters of course. A statue of the Blessed Virgin might weep or bow her head above the blue-flowered rosemary shrubs. Bones of saints buried in the on-site cemetery could be heard rattling to herald the death of a nun. Florentine monasteries also guarded an abundance of holy relics, including 51 authentic thorns from the crown of Jesus and the tunic worn by St. Francis of Assisi when the stigmata first appeared on his body. The difference Suor Maria Celeste discerned between this veil of tears and the harmony of paradise precisely echoed Aristotle's distinction between corruptible earthly matter and the immutable perfection of the heavens. This consonance was no coincidence, but the fruit of the labors of the prolific Italian theologian St. Thomas Aquinas, who grafted the 3rd century BC writings of Aristotle onto 13th century Christian doctrine. The compelling works of St. Thomas Aquinas had reverberated through the church and the nascent universities of Europe for hundreds of years, helping the word of Aristotle gain the authority of Holy Writ, long before Galileo began his book about the architecture of the heavens. Chapter 14. A Small and Trifling Body. By 1626, Galileo had neglected his dialogue for so long that his friends feared he might never return to it. And if not Galileo, then who would step forward to correct humanity's self-centered view of the cosmos? Who better than Galileo to propound the most stunning reversal in perception ever to have jarred intelligent thought? We are not the center of the universe. The immobility of our world is an illusion. We spin. We speed through space. We circle the sun. We live on a wandering star. The apparent steadiness of the earth lulls the mind into a false stability. The body's footing feels so secure that the mind naturally interprets the daily bobbing up and down of the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars as motions entirely external to the earth. Even at night, under the open sky, assaulted by the intimations of infinity, scintillating through the cope of heaven, the mind would rather cede revolution to the universe than relinquish the solace of solid ground. This incontrovertible perception of earthly rest gains support on every hand. The halting drop of each autumn leaf adds weight to the case for stillness. Indeed, if the earth really turned toward the east at high velocity, falling leaves would all scatter to the west of the trees, wouldn't they? Wouldn't a cannon fired to the west carry farther than a salvo to the east? Wouldn't birds lose their bearings in midair? These questions, doubting the earth's diurnal motion, consumed the participants in the dialogue throughout day two of their deliberations. Here, Galileo demonstrated that the moving earth, if it did indeed move, would impart its global motion to all earthly objects. Instead of having to fight this movement in one direction and be abetted by it in the other, they would own it themselves. Just as the passengers aboard a ship may saunter up or down the decks as their bodies travel with more rapid motion through no effort of their own, the 2,000 miles from Venice to Aleppo. As he built up the evidence for the Copernican thesis, Galileo interjected protective reminders regarding his own neutrality. "I act the part of Copernicus in our arguments and wear his mask," Salviati explains to his two companions. "As to the internal effects upon me of the arguments which I produce in his favor, I want you to be guided not by what I say when we are in the heat of acting out our play, but after I have put off the costume, for perhaps then you shall find me different from what you saw of me on the stage." Thus freed to debate all the more forcefully, Salviati shows how a cannon pointed east moves east along with the earth, as does the cannonball loaded inside it. After firing, therefore, the eastward shot has no trouble flying as far as a westward one. Nor do birds, though they fly slower than the earth turns, find their flight adversely affected by the diurnal rotation. "The air itself through which they wander," notes Salviati, "following naturally the whirling of the earth, takes along the birds and everything else that is suspended in it, just as it carries the clouds. So the birds do not have to worry about following the earth, and so far as that is concerned, they could remain forever asleep." As participants in the earth's activity, people cannot observe their own rotation, which is so deeply embedded in terrestrial existence as to have become insensible. "Shut yourself up with some friend in the main cabin below decks on some large ship," Salviati suggests later on the second day, "and have with you there some flies, butterflies, and other small flying animals. Have a large bowl of water with some fish in it. Hang up a bottle that empties, drop by drop, into a wide vessel beneath it. With the ship standing still, observe carefully how the little animals fly with equal speed to all sides of the cabin. The fish swim indifferently in all directions. The drops fall into the vessel beneath. And, in throwing something to your friend, you need throw it no more strongly in one direction than another, the distances being equal. Jumping with your feet together, you pass equal spaces in every direction. When you have observed all these things carefully, though there is no doubt that when the ship is standing still everything must happen in this way, have the ship proceed with any speed you like, so long as the motion is uniform and not fluctuating this way and that. You will discover not the least change in all the effects named, nor could you tell from any of them whether the ship was moving or standing still. Remarkably, Galileo conceded through this early demonstration in relativity, no experiment performed with ordinary objects on the surface of the earth could prove whether or not the world was actually turning. Only astronomical evidence and reasoning from simplicity could carry the argument. Thus, the daily rotation of the earth streamlined the hubbub of the universe and recognized the cosmic balance of power. For if the heavens really revolved with enough force to propel the vast bodies of the innumerable stars, how could the puny earth resist the tide of all that turning? "We encounter no such objections," Salviati replies to his own rhetorical question, "if we give the motion to the earth a small and trifling body in comparison with the universe, and hence unable to do it any violence." When evening falls on the long second day of the dialogue, and the three friends exchange their goodbyes, Simplicio leaves promising to review the modern Aristotelian arguments against the earth's annual motion in preparation for the next day's discussion. Salviati, too, stays up late to study an anti-Copernican text about comets and novas that Simplicio has lent him, and Sagredo lies awake, his thoughts flitting from one cosmological order to the other, eager for a resolution. But somewhere in that second day's night of reflection, Galileo stopped writing, so that the conversation among the dialogue's three characters hung suspended for several years while their author continued thinking through the intricate proofs to be presented, and also tended to other pressing affairs. The long-promised pension for Galileo's son at last became real in 1627 through a bull issued by Pope Urban VIII. Vincenzo was to receive a canonry up north at Brescia, along with an annual income of 60 scudi, except that he refused the offer. Still attending school at Pisa, 21-year-old Vincenzo admitted that he felt a bitter hatred of the clerical state. This confession drove a new wedge between him and his father, and also compelled Galileo to find another recipient for the pension itself. A candidate soon emerged from the ranks of his extended family. In May of 1627, Galileo received a letter from his brother Michelangelo, who now carried on their father's unremunerative musical profession in Munich. Michelangelo proposed to send his wife, Anna Chiara, along with a few of their 8 children, to stay with Galileo in Florence for an unspecified length of time, where the family would be safe from the German turmoil of what eventually came to be called the 30 Years' War. This conflict had begun in 1618 when enraged Protestant noblemen threw 2 Catholic governors out the windows of the royal castle in Prague. The defenestration of Prague renewed long dormant religious bloodshed between Protestant and Roman Catholic states in Germany. In no time, the conflict drew in neighboring countries warring for the political prize at stake, control of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. By 1627, the fighting, almost entirely confined to German soil, embroiled Dutch, Spanish, English, Polish, and Danish armies. If impoverished Michelangelo needed a good excuse to export his family to Italy, the war certainly added substance to his personal reasons. "This arrangement would be good for both of us," Michelangelo wheedled. "Your house will be well and faithfully governed, and I should be partly lightened of an expense which I do not know how to meet. for Chiara would take some of the children with her, who would be an amusement for you and a comfort to her. I do not suppose that you would feel the expense of one or two mouths more. At any rate, they will not cost you more than those you have about you now, who are not so near akin, and probably not so much in need of help as I am." Anna Chiara arrived in July, with all her children in tow, not to mention their German nurse, for a total of 10 additional mouths to feed. Thus, Galileo, at age 63, suddenly found himself the head of a noisy household that included his infant niece, Maria Fulvia, 2-year-old Anna Maria, Elisabetta, 3 unruly boys, Alberto, Cosimo, and little Michelangelo, and Mechilde, the dutiful older daughter. Galileo arranged for his eldest visiting nephew, the 20-year-old Vincenzo, to study music in Rome. He further accommodated the youth by granting to him the papal pension he had secured for his own Vincenzo. Although Michelangelo's Vincenzo evinced genuine musical talent, he disdained to work at his lessons. The Benedictine monk Benedetto Castelli, who had taken Galileo's son in hand in Pisa, had recently been transferred to Rome, where he now tried vainly to keep Galileo's nephew in line. But this Vincenzo stayed out all night with rapscallions, ran up debts, and flouted religious decorum so flagrantly that his Roman landlord threatened to have him denounced to the Holy Office of the Inquisition. In Brescia, meanwhile, resident clerics ignored Galileo's transfer of the pension from one Vincenzo Galilei to another. They elected a citizen of their own town to serve as canon. Galileo waited a few years for the popular Brescian to die and create a new vacancy before he tried to install another family member in that post. With his house filled to the rafters, Galileo abandoned Bello Sguardo when he next fell ill in mid-March of 1628, taking refuge at the home of acquaintances in Florence. "Something in the peaceful air today," Suor Maria Celeste wrote him when he had recovered and returned to his own quarters, "gave me half a hope of seeing you again, sire. Since you did not come, we were most pleased with the arrival of adorable little Albertino, along with our aunt, giving us news that you are well and that you will soon be here to see us. Yet my delight was all but destroyed when I learned that you have already returned to your usual labors in the garden, leaving me considerably disturbed, since the air is still quite raw, and you, sire, still weak from your recent illness. I fear this activity will do you harm. Please do not forget so quickly the grave condition you are in, and have a little more love for yourself than for the garden, although I suppose it is not for love of the garden per se, but rather the joy you draw from it, that you put yourself at such risk. But in this season of Lent, when one is expected to make certain sacrifices, make this one, sire. Deprive yourself, for a time, of the pleasure of the garden." Galileo had considered undertaking a second pilgrimage to Loreto in 1628, marking the decade since his last call at the Casa Santa. He mentioned the possibility in a letter to his brother, and even suggested taking his sister-in-law, Anna Chiara, along with him on the long trek. But his illness prevented him from making such a trip. Instead, Anna Chiara and her children, whom Suor Maria Celeste now referred to as the little rabble-rousers, took their leave. Catholic forces in Germany seemed virtually assured of victory at this point, and in any case, after nearly a year, it was time to go home. Soon after his long-visiting relatives returned to Germany in the spring of 1628, Galileo fell into a tenure wrangle with the University of Pisa. His original appointment to the Tuscan court in 1610 had included a lifetime chair on the university faculty, conferred by Cosimo II. Galileo occupied the honorary position in absentia, with no obligation even to visit Pisa and no mandatory teaching duties to derail him from his more important mission of discovering novelties and announcing them to the world at large for the greater glory of the Grand Duke. But the university administration, tired of honoring the old contract, suddenly moved to dissolve it. Galileo fought back with vigor, and with the full support of Ferdinando II, for although his professional appointment had come through the court, the university paid Galileo's salary of 1,000 scudi annually. By April, Galileo told Suor Maria Celeste of his plans to go to Pisa. In addition to the legal proceedings with the university, which wore on, with and without his presence for nearly 2 years before Galileo emerged victorious, he meant to attend Vincenzo's graduation. Suor Maria Celeste pressed him to do a favor en route for 2 poor nuns at the convent by purchasing several yards of cheap Pisan wool cloth for which they had pooled together 8 scudi. At the Pisan academic ceremonies, Vincenzo collected his doctoral degree in law as the culmination of 6 years of study. Galileo himself had never experienced this rite of passage, having left school without completing his required courses. A more mature Vincenzo now returned home to his father's house at Bellosguardo, where he turned 22 in August. He took to paying regular visits to his sisters at San Matteo, and the following December he delighted Galileo with his decision to marry young Cestilia Boccherini, whose family held prestigious appointments in the Tuscan court. Most beloved Lord Father, the unexpected news delivered here by our Vincenzo regarding the finalization of his wedding plans and marrying into that esteemed family has brought me such happiness that I would not know how better to express it, save to say that, as great as is the love I bear you, sire, equally great is the delight I derive from your every joy, which I imagine in this instance to be immense. And therefore I come now to rejoice with you and pray our Lord to protect you for a very long time, so that you can savor those satisfactions that seem guaranteed to you by the good qualities of your son and my brother, for whom my affection grows stronger every day, as he appears to me to be a calm and wise young man. I would much rather have celebrated with you in person, sire, but if you would be so kind, I implore you to at least tell me by letter how you plan to arrange your visit with Vincenzo's betrothed, meaning whether it may be well to meet in Prato when Vincenzo goes there, or better to wait until she is in Florence, since this is the usual formality among us sisters, and surely, given her experience of having been in a convent, she will know these customs. I await your resolution, and in the meanwhile I bid you adieu from my heart, your most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. Chapter 15. On the Right Path, by the Grace of God. The family of Cestilia Boccherini, Vincenzo's intended, lived above reproach about 12 miles from Florence in the textile city of Prato, famed for its mulberry trees and silkworms. There her father served as major domo at the Medici's local palace, while her brother, Jerry, held a Florentine court position at the Pitti. The Tuscan Secretary of State had contrived to couple Vincenzo with Cestilia entirely to Galileo's satisfaction. The bride brought a dowry of 700 scudi to the marriage, an amount that would have secured her future in her convent had she not been betrothed instead on the eve of her 16th birthday. The wedding date, set for January 29, 1629, allowed the relatives about a month's time for preparations. Although Suor Maria Celeste could not leave San Matteo to attend any of her brother's nuptial festivities, she determined to cater at least part of the wedding feast, to spare her father yet another financial burden. "Here, then, is a list of the more costly items that we will need for making a platter of pastries," she wrote him on January 4th, enclosing a short shopping list of pricey staples, white sugar, almonds, and fine confectioner's sugar, on a small separate square of paper. "Leaving the less expensive ingredients to me. After this, sire, you will be able to see if you want me to cook other sweet things for you, such as savories and the like, because I firmly believe you would spend less this way than buying them already prepared by the grocer's shop, and we will apply ourselves to making them with the utmost possible care. As for the bride's gift, my thoughts lean towards sewing her a beautiful apron," Suor Maria Celeste said later in the same letter, "so as to give her something that would be useful and not require a great expenditure on our part, since we could do all the work ourselves, not to mention that we have no idea how to fashion the high collars and ruffs that ladies are wearing nowadays. I might think I had blundered, sire," she added, "asking your opinion on these many trifles, if I were not absolutely certain that you, in small details just as in great matters, know far more than we nuns do." For his own gift, Galileo helped the newlyweds buy a putty-colored house with a garden and courtyard on the Costa San Giorgio, partway up the road that ascended from Florence to Arcetri. The month after the wedding, in the course of Galileo's continuing correspondence with his faithful friend Castelli, the monk raised the old subject of the solar spots. And Galileo, who prided himself on having long since discovered and published everything worth saying about sunspots, presently began to see a new significance in their behavior that could confirm the Copernican world system. Within a few months, the sunspots would light Galileo's way back to his long-neglected dialogue. Castelli, age 50, now lived in Rome, where Pope Urban VIII had summoned him as a specialist in hydraulics to supervise water and drainage projects around the Holy City. Urban had performed the same kind of consulting work himself years before, when he regulated the waters of Lake Trasimeno for Pope Clement VIII, so he recognized Castelli's expertise. While in Rome, Castelli also taught physics at the college called the Sapienza and wrote a book in 1628 about how to measure running water. He sent Galileo a copy for comment, and during this exchange, late in February 1629, Castelli mentioned the imminent publication of a major new text on sunspots by Galileo's old rival, Father Christopher Scheiner, the Apelles of the Sunspot Letters. Printing problems, however, delayed the appearance of Scheiner's book, the Rosa Ursina, for another 2 years until April of 1631. Castelli also detailed recent observations of a gigantic sunspot that called attention to itself over a period of several weeks. The spot had crossed the body of the sun, disappearing at length around its western limb on February 9th, only to reappear a fortnight later, still recognizable, on February 24th on the sun's eastern horizon. The thought of Scheiner's reprise of sunspots must have nettled Galileo, for he denounced the forthcoming book in his April correspondence, predicting an assortment of errors and irrelevancies. In private, however, he perused his old sunspot files to see what, if anything, he might have missed before. And indeed, he had missed something. He had overlooked the odd way the spots traversed the sun over the course of the year. Their path appeared occasionally to cut straight across the sun's middle, and at other times to trace an upward or a downward slanting arc. Galileo surmised, toward the summer of 1629, that the spots probably stayed a steady course around the sun's equator all the time. They merely appeared to trek uphill or down as the seasons changed because of the annual revolution of the tilted earth around the also tilted sun. The sun thus offered its own physical evidence in support of Copernicus, compounding the testimony of the tides. What a blow to think that Scheiner, who had foolishly mistaken sunspots for stars before Galileo corrected him, now stood ready to publish this monumental discovery. The shock impelled Galileo back to his unfinished manuscript. If he needed further incentive, he could look to the projected income from sales of the finished book, for his new daughter-in-law was already pregnant, his son still unemployed, and Suor Maria Celeste anxious to improve the quality of her life through the purchase of private quarters in the convent. Most beloved Lord Father, the discomfort I have endured ever since I came to live in this house for want of a cell of my own, I know that you know, sire, at least in part, and now I shall more clearly explain it to you, telling you that 2 or 3 years ago I was compelled by necessity to leave the one small cell we had, for which we paid our novice mistress, according to the custom we nuns observe, 36 scudi, and give it over totally to Suor Arcangela, so that, as much as possible, she could distance herself from this same mistress who, tormented to distraction by her habitual moods, posed a threat, I feared, to Suor Arcangela, who often finds interaction with others unbearable. Beyond that, Suor Arcangela's nature being very different from mine, and rather eccentric, it pays for me to acquiesce to her in many things in order to be able to live in the kind of peace and unity befitting the intense love we bear each other. As a result, I spend every night in the disturbing company of the mistress, although I get through the nights easily enough with the help of the Lord, who suffers me to undergo these tribulations undoubtedly for my own good. And I pass the days practically a pilgrim, having no place whatsoever where I can retreat for 1 hour on my own. I do not yearn for large or very beautiful quarters, but only for a little bit of space, exactly like the tiny room that has just become available now that a nun who desperately needs money wants to sell it. And, thanks to Suor Luisa's having spoken well on my behalf, this nun prefers me over any of the others offering to buy it. But because its price is 35 scudi, while I have only 10, which Suor Luisa kindly gave me, plus the 5 I expect from my income, I cannot take possession of the room, and I rather fear I may lose it, sire, if you do not assist me with the remaining amount, which is 20 scudi. I explain this need to you, sire, with a daughter's security and without ceremony, so as not to offend that loving tenderness I have experienced so often. I will only repeat that this is of the greatest necessity on account of my having been reduced to the state in which I find myself, and because, loving me the way that I know you love me, and desiring my happiness, you can well imagine how this step will bring me the greatest satisfaction and pleasure of a proper and honest sort, as all I seek is a little quiet and solitude. You might tell me, sire, that to make up the sum I require, I could avail myself of the 30 scudi of yours that the convent is still holding, to which I respond, aside from the fact that I could not lay claim to that money quickly enough in this extreme case, as the nun selling the room faces dire straits, that you promised the Mother Abbess you would not ask her for those funds until such time as the convent enjoyed some relief from the constraint of constant expenditures. Given all that, I do not think you will forsake me, sire, in doing me this great charitable service which I beg of you for the love of God, numbering myself now among the neediest paupers locked in prison, and not only needy, I say, but also ashamed, since I would not dare to speak so openly of my distress to your face. No less to Vincenzo, but only by resorting to this letter, sire, can I appeal with every confidence, knowing that you will want and be able to help me. And here to close, I send you regards with all my love, and also to Vincenzo and his bride. May the Lord bless you and keep you happy always. From San Mateo, the 8th day of July, 1629. Most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. The novice mistress from whom Suor Maria Celeste and Suor Arcangela purchased their first small room for 36 scudi had been chosen by the abbess as the one to form them in holy living and becoming behavior, according to the practice of the order. But the mistress, who is never mentioned by name in any of Suor Maria Celeste's letters, herself abused the rule because of serious emotional disturbances that provoked her to constant prattling. "The sisters must keep silence from the hour of compline until terce. Let them also be silent continually in the church, in the dormitory." The Rule of St. Clair, Chapter 5. Most of the residents of San Mateo slept in a common dormitory, though the convent contained numerous private chambers that could be bought for a price, over and above the dowry a nun's family members paid to the monastery, and in addition to the allowance they meted out to her for living expenses. In this sense, although every poor Claire lived in poverty, some lived more poorly than others. And yet, because the sisters dined together and shared the same food, the convent's income from the sale of private quarters served to improve the fare for all. "It may not be allowed any sister to send out letters, or to receive anything, or to give anything outside the monastery without permission of the abbess. Nor is it allowed to have anything which the abbess has not given or permitted. But if anything should be sent to a sister by her relatives or by others, the abbess should have it given to the sister. Then, if she needs it, she may use it. Otherwise, let her charitably give it over to a sister in need. If, however, any money would be sent to a sister, the abbess, with the advice of the discreets, should have provision made for her in those things she may need." The Rule of St. Clair, Chapter 8. Galileo sent Suor Maria Celeste the 20 scudi, naturally, But her living situation held even more complexity and danger than the self-conscious, convoluted language of her request could indicate. In fact, she required several months to resolve her plight and find the courage to explain the full chain of events involving the money, the mistress, and the cell to her father, who had resumed his ruminations on the two chief systems of the world. "And to give you some news of my studies," he wrote on October 29th to his lawyer friend Elia Diodati in Paris, "you must know that a month ago I took up again my dialogue about the tides, put aside for 3 years on end, and by the grace of God have got on the right path, so that if I can keep on this winter I hope to bring the work to an end and immediately publish it." The two men had met when Diodati visited Florence in 1620 and maintained an intellectual correspondence ever since. To Diodati, who had been born in Italy but moved first to Geneva and then to Paris because of his family's Protestant faith, Galileo could be perfectly blunt about his book's pro-Copernican slant. "In this, besides the material on the tides, there will be inserted many other problems and a most ample confirmation of the Copernican system by showing the nullity of all that had been brought by Tycho and others to the contrary. The work will be quite large and full of many novelties which, by reason of the freedom of dialogue, I shall have scope to introduce without drudgery or affectation." He presented the new sunspot evidence on day 3 of the dialogue, the day devoted to the discussion of the Earth's annual motion. It came up right after a spirited demonstration of the planetary positions, in which Salviati showed how the errant wanderings of Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn could all be explained by the Earth's plying a yearly orbit between the orbits of Venus and Mars around the Sun. "But another effect," Salviati adds, without pausing for breath, "no less wonderful than this and containing a knot, perhaps even more difficult to untie, forces the human intellect to admit this annual rotation and to grant it to our terrestrial globe. This is a new and unprecedented theory touching the sun itself, for the sun has shown itself unwilling to stand alone in evading the confirmation of so important a conclusion, and instead wants to be the greatest witness of all to this, beyond exception. So now hear this new and mighty marvel." And he proceeds to describe how the sunspots alter their apparent path from the straight line that could be observed only 2 days out of every 365 at the summer and winter solstices, to an arc that curves upward for half the year and downward for the other 6 months. Anyone who clung to the Ptolemaic system, who insisted the sun spun around the earth every day, now had to explain why the sunspots changed the angle of their path according to an annual cycle and not a daily one. Some Aristotelian stalwarts might dredge up the old dismissal of the sunspots as vain illusions of the telescope lenses. More serious and scientific followers of Ptolemy, however, would have to spiral the sun through the most complex gyrations imaginable in order to save these newly recognized appearances in a geocentric and geostationary system. Salviati's explication of the sunspot connection fills only 10 pages of dialogue, including a couple of diagrams to help Sagredo and Simplicio grasp the concept. The three discussants thus find ample time on the third day to consider other imponderables, the size and shape of the firmament, for example, and to converse in awe about the confounding grandeur of space. Responding to Simplicio's Aristotelian vision of the Earth as the center of the world, the center of the universe, the hub of the stellar sphere, Salviati proposes something vaster and vaguer. "I might very reasonably dispute whether there is in nature such a center, seeing that neither you nor anyone else has so far proved whether the universe is finite and has a shape, or whether it is infinite and unbounded." This very modern idea of a universe without end had occurred to Copernicus, but also helped kindle the fire that executed Giordano Bruno, as Galileo knew. He dropped the subject quickly, yet returned again and again in the dialogue to the evident enormity of the heavens. Copernicus had pushed the stars away to unimaginable distances to explain their constancy in contrast to the planets. The reason the stars never seemed to rock this way or that as the Earth traveled all around the sun over the course of the year, Copernicus explained, was that they lay too far away for any shift in position or parallax to be perceived. Galileo agreed, and furthermore predicted that improved observations through powerful future instruments would one day reveal this annual stellar parallax. Simplicio and his fellow Aristotelian philosophers really hated the big, unwieldy universe of Copernicus. They could not believe that God would have wasted so much space on something of no possible use to man. "It seems to me that we take too much upon ourselves," Simplicio counters Salviati, "when we will have it that merely taking care of us is the adequate work of divine wisdom and power, and the limit beyond which it creates and disposes of nothing. I should not like to have us tie its hand so. When I am told that an immense space interposed between the planetary orbits and the starry sphere would be useless and vain, being idle and devoid of stars, and that any immensity going beyond our comprehension would be superfluous for holding the fixed stars, I say that it is brash for our feebleness to attempt to judge the reason for God's actions, and to call everything in the universe vain and superfluous which does not serve us." The quick-witted Sagredo jumps in at this point, bristling that even the remote stars may serve a man in ways he cannot fathom. "I believe that one of the greatest pieces of arrogance, or rather madness, that can be thought of is to say, since I do not know how Jupiter or Saturn is of service to me, they are superfluous and even do not exist. Because, O deluded man, neither do I know how my arteries are of service to me, nor my cartilages, spleen, or gall. I should not even know that I had gall or a spleen or kidneys if they had not been shown to me in many dissected corpses." Sagredo's frequent anatomical analogies throughout the dialogue recall that Andreas Vesalius published his revelations about human anatomy on the fabric of the human body in 1543, the same year as Copernicus's on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres, and with just as much affront to Aristotle. Even while Galileo sat writing the dialogue nearly a century later, Aristotelians still clung to the heart as the origin of the nerves, though Vesalius had followed their course up through the neck to the brain. Vesalius, who took his medical degree at Padua and lectured all over Italy, had also staged sensational popular demonstrations showing the male and female skeletons to contain the same number of ribs, thus defying the widespread belief based on the Book of Genesis that men came one rib short. Although Galileo had left his own medical studies behind by the time he began teaching at Padua in 1592, he undoubtedly attended human dissections by torchlight in the university's tiered anatomical theater, the world's first such facility, where the cadaver could be raised through a trap door in the floor from the canal below, and its body parts burned in a furnace after study. Several of Galileo's acquaintances on the Padua medical faculty, out of necessity, willed their own mortal remains to the university to save the anatomists the bother of pillaging the hospitals or begging the bodies of criminals condemned to hang. "Besides," Sagredo sputters at last in frustration with those who would limit the majesty of the universe, "what does it mean to say that the space between Saturn and the fixed stars, which these men call too vast and useless, is empty of world bodies, that we do not see them, perhaps? Then did the four satellites of Jupiter and the companions of Saturn come into the heavens when we began seeing them and not before? Were there not innumerable other fixed stars before men began to see them? The nebulae were once only little white patches. Have we with our telescopes made them become clusters of many bright and beautiful stars? Oh, the presumptuous, rash ignorance of mankind!" Thus, to imagine an infinite universe was merely to grant Almighty God his proper due. Chapter 16. the tempest of our many torments. All through the autumn of 1629, Galileo gave himself over to the completion of the dialogue, which he finished on Christmas Eve. His health remained strong throughout this period, interrupting his three-month burst of creativity only once, in early November, when Suor Maria Celeste and Suor Luisa treated his brief indisposition by sending him